Absolutely. All right. So I was asked not to present any slides and to encourage discussion. And so I didn't prepare a coherent talk, perhaps, but I will hope to, that you will contribute. So I'll talk about sterile neutrinos and their possible role as the dark matter and the motivation for considering this dark matter candidate comes from the fact that neutrinos have masses, right? So the three flavors of neutrinos have been discovered, and their masses have been measured. And so they need to get some sort of mass terms. And the most economical way to give these left-handed fields masses would be to couple them to a triplet Higgs and give it some expectation value. But there are constraints that come from experiment. And so what people do more frequently is to use the seesaw mechanism. That begins by introducing additional fields. Right?
So, why do you say it's the most natural of the
No, it's the most economical, I said. Economical. Right? The word natural usually unleashes discussion, so I'm preparing this for later.
I think you said natural. But
no, we have a recording. We can go back in the recording. No. Right. Just hold your guns. Naturalness comes next.
But when you couple to Higgs, you mean it would be Majorana masses or
yeah.
A left and right?
Right. So that sentence referred to something that I will not discuss.
Okay.
In fact, Graciela has done some very important work in that direction, right? So that would be Majorana mass, which would be spontaneously breaking lepton.
Yeah, so you're talking about normal, you know, the standard.
Right, so now I'm talking about the normal seesaw mechanism, right? Which begins with staring at the Lagrangian that you have in the standard model and realizing that you need something else, right?
No, but for the seesaw, you don't need any extra.
Right.
You just write the.
Right.
The
you need extra.
You need extra
right-handed fermions. You don't need scalars, but you need right-handed fermions. Right. And so it's, so we need to add some right-handed singlets, and this I runs from one until something. Okay. And the minimal number of these additional states is 2, because you have 2 delta m squareds to explain, so you need at least 2 new fields. Okay. And then one writes the usual Lagrangian, which includes the Yukawa couplings of left-handed neutrinos to these right-handed neutrinos. And so these are gauge singlets. And, of course, there are indices all over. But then the right-handed singlets can also have a Majorana mass, which is another way of making a Lorentz invariant combination from these spinners. So now, if this mass is much greater than YH, then one can write the mass matrix in the form like this. And when one diagonalizes this mass matrix, one gets the light neutrino masses, which are Y squared over M, and one can write the larger, the other Majorana, the other masses, okay, which is of the order of M. Now, so this is the usual seesaw mechanism, and it is actually very appealing and very nice, and the reason many people like it is the fact that even for Yukawa coupling of order one, one can explain very small neutrino masses. So if the Yukawa coupling is of order one, one can get M nu, which is much smaller than the expectation value of the standard model Higgs. Now this story fits very well in models with grand unification, because, for example, if you have Suzy Gutz with SO10 gauge group, this has a 16-dimensional representation of fermions. And that representation contains a state which is a standard model singlet. So this is this contains what it contains this N, which is standard model singlet. So it all works out very nicely. And then in this theory, when you break this group spontaneously, you can naturally give the Majorana mass to these fields, which is of the order of the Gutz scale. And that's the large mass, and all of this works out very well.
Indeed, just a comment that it's also true without SUSY. SO10 can have intermediate scale and
right.
Get
okay.
Unification. So
exactly. Or SUSY-less Gutz with intermediate skills.
Otherwise known as
That's right. It's like teaching the standard model by starting with the MSSM and then.
Exactly.
That's right. The non-supersymmetric limit of the MSSM. That's right. All right. Okay. So this story is appealing, elegant, but not unique. Right? So this is not the only possibility with this Lagrangian, because this condition does not imply this condition. Okay. So in other words, there's a big if here. We don't know whether Suzy Gutz is the right, or non-Suzy Gutz is the right ultraviolet completion of the standard model. And so far, the data doesn't, these things don't jump out from the data. Hopefully, one will discover something in the next LHC run that will suggest what is beyond the standard model. But in principle, the standard model could be a valid theory to higher scales. And we still don't know what the value of the Yukawa coupling is.
So what is in a SUSY gut? What could be the maximal scale you put the SUSY? I mean, up to.
Oh, you can. You can have SUSY very. I mean, and still have unification of couplings.
Yeah.
Well, you need intermediate scales. That's right. So you need some intermediate scales to make the couplings.
But intermediate can also mean like 100 TeV or.
Well, you need some staged breaking at different scales, because if you just eliminate SUSY, then the couplings don't meet. So then what you do, you have to throw in some thresholds, and I have not followed.
We have the experts.
Exactly, you have the experts. That's right.
Well, I think without SUSY, unification occurs when the intermediate scale is between 10 to the 11 to 10 to the 14 GeV.
Mm-hmm.
So if you adopt that, that means SUSY could be above that scale.
Okay.
So completely out of reach of experiments.
So it's not guaranteed to be able to see that.
In this context.
So what do we know about the Yukawa coupling? So let's just forget this for a moment, okay, and just examine other possibilities. The motivation remains that we want to know what's sitting in the neutrino sector and how it's working, and we don't know yet what the Yukawa couplings are, what the scales of the Majorana masses are. But in addition, there is also a motivation that comes from dark matter. Right? Dark matter requires at least one particle that is not part of the standard model. And we have just introduced two or more particles that are not part of the standard model. So it turns out that one of them can be dark matter. And that's interesting. All right, so what do we know about Yukawa complex? Now, not much.
Dark matter, the band of what is the range of the mass is about, right?
Right, so for dark matter, you need this particle, or actually the mixture of this and this, to be stable. And so the mass can be very high, because the decay rate is proportional to the fifth power of that mass, right? And that condition alone already tells you that you won't have, you know, gut scale masses. You will have lower masses. And then when you combine it with other constraints and consider production in the early universe, you end up with a KeV mass range.
KeV. Which implies that Y is very small.
Which is why I want to examine what do we know? Is Y of order one, or is Y very small? Okay.
Alex, yes. Isn't there another obvious alternative that Y is not very small, that there is some symmetry which reduces the rank of the matrix so that somebody gets a protected mass?
Right. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So that
making Y very small, I don't know, it's somehow it's counter to the original motivation of the seesaw.
Absolutely.
That doesn't mean it's not small, but it's
right. It's counter to the motivation of the seesaw. Yes. But it's not the exactly. So what? It's not the motivation for the seesaw. I'll argue it's an interesting consequence of the seesaw. Okay?
So if you make Y small, you can also do the Higgs triplet model.
Right. Yes, that's right. That's right.
Just two minor.
That's right. That's right.
There's no extra neutrinos, but there's a Higgs triplet.
That's right. Exactly. I mean, the motivation. If we stick with the motivation, I mean, there are many, many things that people do which has nothing to do with the motivation, right? I mean,
MSW, original motivation was small mixing angle.
Exactly.
And it's
exactly.
Small, it still works.
Yeah. Evolutionary motivation for sex is reproduction, but that's not why people do it, right?
So. Alex, the trouble with remarks like that is that people are going to walk away remembering that remark.
Oh, shut it off.
Let's pretend Alex by attributing that remark to Bob.
Exactly. Obviously. Fortunately, your reputation exceeds my reputation. Okay. Anyway, so.
No, but essentially, when you are saying this dark matter, it means that effectively you are imagining the number of light neutrinos, right? Because then you are saying that it's
exactly.
A different world, right?
Right, where, exactly. So if these guys all live at a very high scale,
yeah.
There's no observable consequences at low energy. Now, if one of them is brought down below the electroweak scale, there are all sorts of interesting consequences, right? And first, you know, let's just do a sanity check. I mean, is it crazy? Okay. So what do we know about Yukawa coupling? In the standard model, they are not derived from anything, right? They're just put in. And if you believe in string theory, then, well, there are different possibilities. For example, in some string theory models, these Yukawa couplings are the intersection numbers of Calabi-Yau manifolds, and they're just numbers of order one. But in some other models where you have extra dimensions and different fermions are stuck on different brains, these numbers are greatly suppressed by the smallness of the overlap of the wave function of some neutrino with our brain if that neutrino is stuck to the wrong brain. Okay? And I'll discuss in more detail how these can be generated. Okay? But we don't, a priori, we don't know what these values are. People can use naturalness as a way to eliminate some ugly possibilities. Okay? There are different ways of formulating what is natural. For example, one can, so can we use naturalness? to distinguish between these possibilities? Well, there are different ways. One is sort of perturbative naturalness. And in this approach, people say that if you have, you know, the tree level contribution plus one loop contribution plus whatever, and ending up to something that's much smaller than either of these, then it's not natural. Okay? But here, if you have a very small Yukawa coupling and a small mixing between this guy and that, now you do the loops, those loops are not large because there's a huge suppression just from the coupling. So in that sense, in the perturbative sense, it's not unnatural to have this possibility. Okay.
But look, say, mass of electron, is it natural to be that small?
What's that?
Mass of electron. Is it natural to
absolutely
be that small?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with you. I agree with you. Okay.
For fermions, it's also
it's
like this because you need
exactly
loop corrections.
Exactly.
To
so the
mass
symmetry
exactly
increases when y, when you put y to zero, the symmetry increases, right?
Okay. So that's okay. That's very good. Okay. So there's a different way. Thank you. So there's a different way to formulate naturalness, and that's Atoff's criterion. Okay? And Atoff's criterion is basically saying that if there's a small number, it is natural for that number to be small if setting it to zero increases symmetry of the theory. Okay? So some small number is okay if epsilon equals zero corresponds to a new symmetry. Yeah, because then one could say that this symmetry is protecting epsilon, and the small breaking of that symmetry is the reason why epsilon is not zero. So what can we say with respect to the Yukawa couplings? Well, if you set Yukawa couplings to zero, you actually regain new symmetry. You get lepton number in the Lagrangian. Right? And so in that sense, it is also natural. Now, one could argue that lepton number by itself is not strong enough a symmetry to protect anything, and it needs protection on its own. But that's a different story. There are models where people have used this, you know, new symmetries, okay, new symmetries to explain why Yukawas are much smaller than one. And now Arkady's argument is also valid, that the Yukawa coupling of the electron is very small, and so just by staring at the parameter, at the world we have in front of us, we can't eliminate these possibilities, small numbers that we have not yet explained. Not to mention the cosmological constant or other small numbers that we have not yet explained.
But now you are assuming that you only have the KV stereo neutrino, right? I mean, you don't have like the G gas state.
I know you could. I
mean, oh, you could, absolutely.
Like,
absolutely.
And then you decouple the.
Absolutely, absolutely. For example, let me.
You have to genesis is another problem.
Absolutely. So now let's talk about some models. Okay. So
before we go to model, isn't there another criterion for strong naturalness due to Dirac, which says that all dimensionless coupling should be order one in order for them to be natural?
Well, why?
So
I understand this. Okay, so this is a very nice way of saying why some dimensionless numbers are small, right? Because then you relate to symmetry. And there are some good examples. The pions are light because of the chiral symmetry, right?
Some people use this use that term technically natural for the hooked naturalness.
Right,
stable under gradient correction.
No, these are two different things. They're philosophically distinct, because here you start with the tree level and you add loops and you see what happens in perturbation theory. Perturbation theory is human invention, right? If you start from the wrong vacuum or quantize around the wrong background, you will get all sorts of mess, right? So this is your invention. You like tree level because you're big and you live in a tree level world, okay? But this is human invention. This one is this is really divine, right? This is a criterion that has nothing to do with human invention. Yes, exactly. 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 Okay.
I agree with Babu that the one implies the other, right?
Right. But these are philosophically different criteria. Do you agree with that? Okay, but again, this, so what the entire point I'm making here is that this is just a sanity check, right? That considering Yukawa much smaller than one doesn't contradict anything we know about nature.
But Alex, doesn't that point grant you directly to the question why would you add the extra neutrinos?
But how would I not? I mean, I do need my structure here. I need Dirac mass.
The extra, if you just have a small Yukawa, you don't need to.
Small Yukawa with what? See, there is a doublet and a doublet.
You can have the Dirac neutrino, right?
Well, but I need a right-handed counterpart. I cannot have a Dirac neutrino with just left-handed fields.
Yeah.
So what's the question?
I think the question is, why do you even write the Majorana mass for the right?
Okay. So because it's not because nothing prevents me from doing that. And in principle, yes, I could have. That's right. However, I do know that I need dark matter.
Yeah, because you can erase that one, and then you would have right-handed neutrino, and that's it. So there is nothing, and it will be Dirac mass. This is okay.
That's right. This is okay. But
no, I'm not saying that. It's okay. So this, I'm saying that the original just did get out of the sea, so it's just about
Hours. So you're just going beyond where I am, right? So I'm just trying to argue that M doesn't have to be enormously large, and that it can be, in principle, at lower scales. And you're saying that it can go even to zero, and I have no problem with that.
The issue of principle is that you started with sterile neutrinos, which are additional light states, right? And then you're connecting them to the right-handed partners here, and that's not necessarily required, right? Just imagine another light state having things that still do seesaw for you, but are in a massive sector which is not physical.
I'm just looking about the structure, right? You're saying that this parameter is allowed to be zero.
I don't care about that parameter. That parameter could be the gut scale.
Right.
Just going back one step, right?
Right.
You could have an additional light neutrino, which is not doesn't have the standard model gauge quantum numbers,
right?
And it mixes through some dimension 5 operators with the other ones,
right?
And there could be right-handed guys which are just somewhere where they want their one but by
the but there's something different.
Right.
What's the difference?
You're referring to some dimension 5 operator, and I'm just peering inside that dimension 5 operator. I'm going to see something like this.
So these are right-handed. I'm saying that the cell between us could be left-handed states.
Well, they will end up interacting through mixing.
I mean, I think you started on the wrong foot. You are trying to motivate what you're coming up with is nature instead of saying I want to have dark matter.
That's not my motivation. What I'm saying is that neutrino masses can be easily accommodated through a seesaw mechanism. Okay? And this structure contains enough degrees of freedom to explain dark matter. And now I'm examining this possibility. So before I go into production in the real universe and parameters, I want to make sure that I'm not doing something stupid, right? That I'm not violating some laws of nature in the process. Okay?
So you're saying you still want to explain the three neutrino masses or two neutrino mass differences and have at least one of these extra gauge singlets be a dark matter.
That will be the end result. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so this.
I'm saying the contradiction, there's no contradiction. You could still have your seesaw.
Yes.
To make the light between the masses. You could have additional light states.
Yes.
There is no requirement that y has to be much less than one and so forth in that case.
No, but he's discussing scenario where this right-handed partner is light.
Yes.
It is what he's discussing. And then it doesn't matter whether you do it this way or other way.
Right.
The point is that if you take, say, m equals zero, you have degeneracy. You have two particles, left-handed and right-handed, with the same mass, right? I mean, one mass for those states. And then you're saying, separate out this right-handed, okay? And he's trying to separate it not too far.
This is a standard scenario where people take the right-handed guy of the seesaw and bring it down. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying, philosophically, this is not required to have a light sterile neutrino dark matter.
Of course it's not.
It's not. You could have light states, which are serve as dark matter, and have your seesaw and be perfectly happy with it. Mm-hmm.
With
the right-handed guys which are heavy. So,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. So we're all in agreement. Good. Okay. So we haven't encountered any no-go theorems so far. So let me just give you a couple of existence proofs that you know how this can arise in an otherwise sensible theory. Okay. So one possibility is let me consider. You know, I mentioned the extra dimensions, right? So let me consider a seesaw, which is a split seesaw. I need at least two of these to make my Yukawa, my mass matrix to work. But I can have let me see if I okay. So I probably won't. Don't want to write everything. Okay. So what I want is to introduce one extra dimension. Okay. So this is our four-dimensional world, and I have two and two and three singlets localized on the same world where the standard model lives. And I have the other one localized on the wrong brain at some distance L from us. And this is an example of a structure that splits the masses of these particles. So what happens here is that both Yukawa coupling and the Majorana mass are suppressed exponentially. Okay. By something that has a square root of e to the some mass times L. Okay. However, so in the four-dimensional low energy effective theory, the perceived Yukawa coupling will be the five-dimensional Yukawa coupling suppressed by some large number.
But there only the couplings 2 and 1 are suppressed, right?
Right.
And 2 and 3 are living in the standard model.
Right. That's right. So, but the beauty of it is that when you square this suppression factor and divide by this, you don't get any suppression. So the result is that you see a very small Yukawa coupling and a very small Majorana mass, but the seesaw formula works in both four dimensions and in five dimensions. Okay. So this is an example how these perceived Yukawa couplings could be very small because they are exponentially suppressed by the size of the other dimension. There are other ways in which you can produce this structure. For example, this can come from an expectation value of some singlet, of the singlet Higgs. Okay, and that is interesting from the point of view of production of these particles in the early universe, because these particles can decay. Okay.
What would you do with the quartic coupling to the Higgs?
No, you just have a singlet mixed with the standard model Higgs.
S square H square coupling, and that get at one loop, the mass of that S goes over 1 kV. So you need
No. You have your Yukawa coupling in front. So the S expectation value is ultra weak. Right, but then you open a new. I mean, okay. So let me discuss that model. Okay. So if you replace M with the new Yukawa coupling times the expectation value of a singlet Higgs, okay, then
that lambda is small.
That lambda is small. It turns out that you naturally produce the right amount of dark matter in this model, because if this is at the electroweak scale, as soon as you touch this piece in the Lagrangian, you allow a new mode of production, that S, can decay into sterile neutrinos. And if you calculate how many of them you produce, you end up with the right abundance.
And this has to happen after inflation, so it doesn't inflate away.
Right, no, it happens at the electroweak scale. Because these go out of equilibrium at the electroweak scale. So this, and the mass of S also is at the electroweak scale. So from this, if you want a kV-ish mass for stable dark matter, then you need lambda to be 10 to the minus 8 to get the kV mass from this.
So don't you see the scale idea that you see?
Yes, okay, so look, that's right, so just a moment. So then you get something like this. So it's an interesting coincidence that the production of dark matter particles from S decays gives you the right amount of dark matter for the coupling that gives you kV mass. Okay, so this is a... It's one of the models, but it's a nice one. For the LHC, the only way you will see a singlet mixed with the doublet is by measuring the branching ratios of Higgs decay and seeing that they don't end up as they would in the standard model.
This is consistent with the standard model right now, right?
It's not. It's consistent. Yeah. So unfortunately, it will take 10 years of LHC running to see any mixing, kind of the order of 0.1 mixing terms between the singlets and the Higgs. So there's a possibility to discover that the Higgs, that the singlet is mixed in there, but it's not a strong constraint.
But they could try to find not a mixing, but singlet itself, no?
Right. So particle. That's right. So there will be a bump. That's right. So again, this is consistent because the present data is analyzed under the assumptions that there is only one bump in the spectrum, and then you get the 125 GeV Higgs. If you relax that constraint, then you wouldn't have the discovery power, which means that we don't have enough data to see more peaks, more bumps. Okay.
No, it could, but the mass of this S should not be just around the same mass as Higgs, right?
No, that's right. But that's right. But so right now, the presence of a singlet in the Higgs sector is not well constrained.
But this S carries lepton number. So it depends on how you couple it, but
right.
If it's coupled onto a sterile neutrinos,
right.
You would have a very hard time. It would
That's
be
right.
a bump that goes into a
right.
visible channel, so
exactly.
No
bump.
It's missing energy.
That's right. That's right. So a better way to discover it is to actually measure the branching ratios of the standard model Higgs. Right. That's right.
So okay. Unless you, here you assume just standard freeze-out production. Okay. Right.
No, this is not freeze-out.
Not freeze-out?
This is decay. Okay, no. This is not freeze-out, not oscillations, okay? So here I assume that oscillations do not produce too much of dark matter.
This has nothing to do with
the mixing angle is smaller than what you would need for Dudelson-Widgerow production.
Yes.
Okay? So here, the S particles, because they have mass of 100 GeV, these S particles are present in plasma. And these particles are out of equilibrium. So there's some leakage from plasma into this out of equilibrium. And there's no return.
But it's always out of equilibrium.
It's always out of equilibrium. Okay? So there's no return. And then at the temperature when S goes out of equilibrium, so these decays saturate, I mean, the most of M particles are produced at the last point because the expansion rate of the universe is slowest.
Right, so this is a normalizable interaction. That's why it behaves this way, right?
Right. So so it goes this way, but there's no reverse reaction.
The standard weak scenario is because it has a funny non-normalizable interaction gives you energy dependence.
And the temperature of the S mass, they go both ways, but there's essentially no decay.
No,
the coupling is weak enough that they never are in equilibrium.
Right. So these particles are never reaching the equilibrium density. So it only goes one way at all temperatures.
Aren't this very hot then for being dark matter?
No. That's actually much colder than Dudelson-Widgerow. Because
S is at the electroweak
yes.
scale, right?
Right. So, right. So the energies of these particles are of the order of temperature. Right? Wait. However, this happens, that you produce them when the temperature is of the order of ms. And the temperature is 100 GeV. And so subsequent cooling of the universe produces KeV. Okay? So the subsequent cooling of the universe produces entropy when the standard model degrees of freedom go out of equilibrium. So that dilutes and redshifts this component of dark matter. So this component is just sitting out of equilibrium. So, okay, so what I'm saying is that if there was no dilution, the momentum distribution of these particles would be very similar to Dodelson-Widrow particles. However, because of the dilution, their momenta get redshifted by a factor cubic root of 33, which is about 3.5. Okay? And so this produces a colder component of the same particles as neutrino oscillations was produced.
These are like the standard WIMPs, maybe even colder.
These are not colder than the standard WIMPs. These are slightly warmer than the...
Is that right? I mean, parametrically, right? It depends
They're colder than Dodelson-Widrow component. They're colder than anything you can see in Lyman alpha. Okay? But...
Which is a good thing, because otherwise
yes,
it would be...
Yes. So in this model, generically, you predict two components of dark matter. Right? So there's one component that is always produced. So let me actually...
The Dodelson-Widrow mechanism is forbidden at this point by a combination of the bounds on mixing and...
That's right. So Dodelson-Widrow is the production just from neutrino oscillations. Of course, these are all mixtures of all, okay? This oscillates in the sterile neutrinos. So this occurs, it's mainly occurs at a temperature of about 100 MeV. And there's not much dilution after that, because this is already below the electroweak, the QCD repackaging of degrees of freedom. Now, the singlet decay into ends occurs at a temperature of 10 to the 2 GeV. And then there is a dilution. So this omega already includes the dilution. And redshifting. Okay? So the momenta of these particles get, they start out of the order of temperature, just like here. But then they get diluted by something like this. Because 33 is the ratio of degrees of freedom, effective degrees of freedom above and below.
Momentum redshifts. But the temperature does. Okay.
Right, exactly. Right. Because they're sitting outside plasma. Right, exactly. So they just see the expansion rate.
But where did you get that 33 from?
I'm just counting degrees of freedom in the standard model.
No, but you don't. Shouldn't you compare the difference at 100 GeV and... And it's not a factor of 33.
Yeah, it is.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I think so.
No.
That's a cubic root.
Yeah. Yeah.
No,
oh, sorry, it's
100
a cubic root.
MeV.
Oops.
No.
But that, Alex, my point was that in the Dodelson-Widrow, you have a distribution which is close. It's basically the same distribution.
Yes.
Just reduce the because of the mix and over
all. Right.
But in the other case, you are producing them not thermally, so they are very, very hot in the production. Then
it's the same distribution roughly.
Why? I mean,
because through
SDK,
because
right?
Because the distribution of S is thermal.
Fine, but the mass of M is much smaller than S.
No.
The mass is zero.
No, the mass is yes, but the momenta are the mass of S, and all of it is 10 to the 2 GeV, and the temperature is 10 to the 2 GeV.
And it's never thermal, right? Because it's never thermalized, so it depends.
It's never thermal, but the mean momentum is of the order of the temperature.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, both in this case and in this case before dilution, and after dilution, you gain this nice factor, which makes it a colder dark matter. So in this scenario, you have a two-component dark matter. In fact, in every scenario, you'll have a two-component dark matter. Okay, which is interesting from the point of view of structure formation. If you see some anomalies, some inconsistencies in structure formation on the small scales, then it could be a mixed dark matter, the same particles, but some of them come with the from oscillations of neutrinos and have a warmer, kind of longer mean free pass, longer free streaming lengths. And the other component is colder. Now, in this scenario, the same thing is true. Because here, the production happens not from decays of some particles, but from, actually, the B minus L is present here, and it's broken at a high scale. And then in that transition, you have these particles in equilibrium until B minus L is broken. Because these particles can interact through B minus L, gauge bosons, and nothing else. And once that transition occurs, then they're out of equilibrium. And that transition, if it is first order, also dilutes these particles. So then you have two stages of dilution. One at a high temperature, and the other one from the standard model. Right? So then split seesaw. Produces dark matter with momentum, which is T over some other dilution factor over 3.5. So this, again, the same particles, but produced in an even colder state with even lower momentum. So you can have a two-component distribution in the moment. And that's interesting because dark matter simulations, you know, there are some statements that one can make about warm dark matter, some statements that one can make about cold dark matter, but it is actually, I don't think people have studied a combination of the two just yet, and that would be interesting.
You could also have the decay of the heavier steran neutrino into the lightest.
Yes.
So that generates another.
Yes. That's right. That mode is a little bit suppressed or strongly suppressed by the mixing. So in most of these cases, I will consider mixings which are much smaller than would make that channel significant. But I suppose that, yeah, that could be.
Alex, you could also, I suppose, put into an N3 on the second brain and have lots of components.
That's right. Moreover, because of this exponential suppression, this doesn't tell you that the mass is KeV. It just tells you that all scales are equal. Right? You have democracy of scales. You're shooting from a high scale with exponential suppression. You can land at the KeV or below or above. So this, and if you have more right-handed states and they're on this brain, you can have different masses. You can have more particles, more sterile neutrinos with different masses in this model.
So I don't know if I have a problem with these pictures. Pictures are very nice because they're motivated top-down, so you build a model that's self-survivably complete. But whenever you introduce new particles or fields, you introduce new mixings, you introduce new parameters, and so you're bound to be able to explain more because you have new parameters. But I don't know where I'm going with this. The parameters, you're relating them to a model, which is very nice.
I think
you're always going to get more parameters.
I think my argument is the following, that neutrinos have masses, and that could imply the existence of right-handed neutrinos. There is nothing wrong with right-handed neutrinos that couple with the small Yukawa couplings. And as an existence proof, I can list some models. Now I will take a very phenomenological approach and say, OK, so there are possibilities, which don't contradict anything, that produce dark matter in the form of sterile neutrinos. What do I know about it? Can I exclude it based on something, right? So I know that it's produced in the universe in the right amount in more than one model. I know that dark matter that results from this production can have dark matter sterile neutrinos with different momenta distributions. And so the dark matter could be multi-component. And now I'm going to discuss some other places where I would try to constrain these particles or discover new effects.
Yeah, I think the field needs a smoking gun of discovery.
Right.
You invalidate things.
Right. So, exactly. So, Exactly. So how are we going to discover it?
Can I ask a question about the abundance of these sterile neutrinos?
Yes.
You said the S decays when the temperature is about its mass.
Right.
Therefore, the abundance of S's and photons at that time are about equal.
Right.
So the dilution is only by the fact that you've shown.
Right.
But to get a KeV dark matter particle, you need dilution by about a factor of, I don't know, 1,000 or 100.
No, it works out. It works out because not all of them decay this way, right? So there is a mixing between the standard model Higgs and S. And that's the way S decays. S mostly decays into other things,
okay.
Right? So there's a small.
So you have a branching ratio. So
there's a small leakage into this out of equilibrium state. Absolutely.
So just one more question on that model. So when you have lambda of 10 to the minus 8, right? That's
right.
Because you are thinking about the KV.
KV. Because.
But in principle, right? Now all bets are off.
Yeah.
So what?
Right. So here the nice coincidence is that if I specify, if the Higgs lives where the other Higgs lives, okay. And if I specify the mass of the particle for which it is stable and can favor dark matter, then I get the right abundance. So there's only one coincidence, not 10
coincidences. The coincidence is that it's out of equilibrium, so in principle you produce either too much or too little, and you tune it to be just right.
No, because if I... So here's the coincidence.
That's why it's so sensitive to lambda, right?
Okay, so let me go the other way around. I could have gotten, for the right abundance, I could have gotten mass of an MeV, and then it would not live long enough. Or I could have gotten a mass of EV, and then it wouldn't be cold enough. You want to see coincidence in that direction, then there is coincidence in that.
So you dial the abundance with lambda.
Right, and then I discovered that the mass is just right to be dark matter. Or I said the mass to be right to be dark matter, and then I get the right abundance. It's one way or the other.
Alex, are you assuming that S carries lambda?
Yes.
I mean,
Yes. I mean, I would say that the lepton number is spontaneously broken. Yes. So it has to be a real scalar. It cannot be. Otherwise, there would be a Meyer on there.
What kind of decays? It's through loops of Higgs or something.
Yeah. Because it's mixed. So the physical Higgs is a mixture of these two states.
So you have gauged B minus L in this model? Is that what you're saying?
In this one, not in this model.
So what's wrong with having a Majorana?
Because there's nothing wrong with having a Majorana except my dark matter would decay into it too fast.
Mm-hmm. What about having a light sterile neutrino, for example, electron volt sterile neutrino, heavier one?
Yeah, it can. Yeah, you can have it here if there is another field step.
And it will be stable enough to be around the dark matter.
Right. So then, okay. So now we have to, just for completeness, let me add something else here. I would probably put it closer to Douglas and Widrow, and that is Shi Fuller. Mechanism when it's the oscillations where you hit a MSW resonance at some point. Okay. And then the resonance picks out certain momenta over some other momenta, and as a result, you get a colder population than Dolton-Widrow, but hotter population than from this or from this. Okay. So this is colder.
You need a very large lepton asymmetry.
Exactly. That's right. You need large lepton asymmetry.
In the case of gauging B minus L, wouldn't the sterile neutrino be in thermal equilibrium all the way down to some few hundred MeV?
No.
If the B minus L scale is, say, the TV or so?
Well, TV, yes, but
what, so what
no, no, here the scale is gut scale.
Oh, is that the gut scale?
Yeah, that's right.
But again, like the second model, right? In the second model, you choose the mass of your sterile neutrino to be a KeV because on the one side, you don't want it to decay too fast.
Right.
On the other side, you don't want it to be warm or hot.
Right.
And then you say, what lambda do I need to make that happen?
Right.
Where is the coincidence or what's the coincidence?
So you choose the mass,
yes.
You compute your lambda,
mm-hmm.
and then you ask, what is the abundance? And the abundance comes out right.
Okay.
Or you choose the abundance, you infer lambda, and you ask, what is the mass? And the mass comes out right.
You're saying 10 to the minus 8 you call out. That gives you KV, right. That also...
Right, three equations with two numbers, right. So if you satisfy three equations with two numbers, it's one coincidence.
No, but you can always add more and make more equations.
Than... You already said there was a hidden extra parameter, the branching ratio.
No.
That's just determined by lambda?
No, the branching, as long as the mixing here is not as small, is not too small, right? Then mixing is irrelevant.
But then tell me again how you dilute the number of neutrinos from the number of S.
So the production is, all right, let's calculate the production. So the number density that you produce of these ends equals the rate of S to NN times the time you have available. The time that you have available is the Hubble time when this is happening. And the Hubble time is M Planck over T squared. The rate here is Yukawa coupling squared times the mass of S, okay, divided by some 4 pi. Okay, so now we multiply this by M Planck over T squared. And if you want the ratio of this number density to T cubed, you divide this by T cubed. Okay? Now, this is of the order of T, this is of the order of T, this is very small, this is very large. This is how you get this number here.
Is there S particles left over?
No, the S particles disappear. The S particles are always in equilibrium because of their interactions with the Higgses. So S and Higgs are mixed, strongly mixed. If that mixing is very, very tiny or zero, then what you say is true because then all S's have to go somewhere and they have to go into N's. Okay? This is not the case. So for S, my number density is just, it's temperature cubed above the S mass, and then it gets suppressed by Boltzmann suppression.
There's some small remnant left over in the masses, but they're not.
Due to detailed balance, number of S's equals the number of H's.
Basically, the way you solve the problem that Gary is worried about is with that coupling.
There's absolutely.
Constant there that you're putting in.
That's the okay. So this coupling is actually my lambda. Okay, that's my lambda. So now, if I fix this, this tells me what lambda is, and the coincidence is that the mass comes out KeV, which is good for dark matter being just right. If I set the lambda from here, then the coincidence is that the abundance comes out just right. There is a coincidence. You satisfy two equations with one parameter. That's
a nice thing about it.
Thank you. That's right.
You have two components of dark matter.
Yes.
So one's the
other abundance is determined by the mixing angle, which is the ratio of this to this. Now, this Yukawa coupling is unrelated to this Yukawa coupling. And therefore, I don't know how much of the other component I have.
But you don't want the omega to be 0.2 necessarily. But this pretty one component.
Yes, I can make it 0.1.
So you're assuming that the mixing between the active and sterile states is small enough that the sterile is now thermalized.
That's right.
And what's that mixing angle? How large could it be?
Okay, so the exclusion plot, mixing angle squared, mass. So the exclusion plot is roughly like this, where if I take this to be sine squared theta, If I take this to be 10 to the minus 9, this is a few keV. I don't know, 3 keV. And so here, you would produce all dark matter from oscillations. But here, you would overproduce dark matter. Here, you produce too little. So this is excluded. And then there is X-ray, sort of bounds from X-rays, which I will discuss in a moment, that cuts off some other piece. Okay? So they're at a different angle in the same plane. All right, so now, so production in the early universe gives us some constraints. What do these particles do? They decay. But they decay on the timescales, which are much longer than the age of the universe. And the primary mode of decay is, of course, just through mixing the right-handed neutrino, sterile neutrino, mixed, let me call it when it is mixed, sterile neutrino. Okay, it can go into light neutrino, right? And through Z boson, and Z boson can give you two more neutrinos. But this is not an interesting mode of decay because you don't see anything. You see keV neutrinos. A much more interesting mode of decay is when you mix this with some active neutrino, you send a W around, there is a lepton running here, and then you go to a lighter neutrino and a photon. Or you can attach a photon here. Okay? And so you can attach a photon here or here. So this is a loop-suppressed decay. It's not the dominant decay, but that's the first visible mode. And this produces a photon with the energy which is mass over 2. It's two-body decay. So there is a possibility to discover these particles or to set constraints by observing or non-observing a line in an X-ray spectrum.
And the lifetime for this?
And the lifetime for this is ridiculously long, 10 to the 24 seconds, and then there is you cover in mass, okay?
So because we found already.
Right, okay, exactly. Now, so how do you measure, how do you discover such a small decay rate? How do you discover a small number? The only way to measure a small number is to multiply it first by a large number, okay? So what you do is you point an X-ray telescope to a large number of these particles. Right? And if it is dark matter, then a clump of dark matter is your target. You point an X-ray telescope and you look for a line. And so Mike Lowenstein and I have teamed up and observed specifically for this. So people have done archival data analysis for this purpose for a while. And then Mike Lowenstein and I got dedicated time on all three X-ray telescopes, not at the same time, to observe dwarf spheroidal galaxies in search for this dark matter. And we set some constraints and so on. And recently, Bulbul et al., a team from Harvard Smithsonian, analyzed stacked spectra of clusters. So they take different clusters at different redshifts. They correct for the redshift and they stack them. And in that stacked spectrum, they see a bump at 3.5 keV, which corresponds to 7 keV mass. And the same bump, only weaker, appears in some nearby systems, but then when you stack them. So that line could be a great discovery, or it could be one of the gaseous lines that is not modeled properly, or it could be something else. And we will know the answer in 2 years.
When?
On this date, 2 years from now. Exactly. So next year, AstroH will be launched, and this will be a new X-ray telescope, which will have energy resolution 50 times better than anything we have today. And the beauty of it is that if you're looking for a line, then of course it is very spread out by the instrumental resolution, right? If the instrumental resolution is 50 times the width of the line, then you don't, then you spread it out. But if your instrument is geared specifically for that width, then it's going to be a beautiful line or nothing. And the other thing is you will never confuse that line with atomic line because there's no way that it would coincide. Here, you get all sorts of atomic lines.
Right. And so, after we actually see the astrophysical line width, right?
Right.
Yes. See the line width, which is not possible for atomic.
Yes, exactly.
So right. What's the dominant decay mode? You said this is not the dominant
one. The dominant
one?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Okay, so.
So Alex, if I make the other dark matter the dominant,
So the broadening of the line depends a little bit on the momentum distribution, but that's not going to be seen with AstroH. I mean, you will see that it's different shape from atomic lines. But
so, tell me again, or maybe you were intending to go there, the difference between looking at clusters and looking at, say, dwarf spheroidals. Clusters, you know there's hot gas and there are atomic lines.
Right.
Dwarf spheroidals, you don't have that problem.
That's right.
So are you going to say, or is
right? So the backgrounds are very different. The analysis is very different. Dwarf spheroidals are the darkest place in the universe in terms of background, and you have a lot of dark matter and nothing else, and so it's easier to analyze from that point of view. But clusters have been observed for many, many seconds. Right, so. We get 100 kiloseconds per dwarf spheroidal every time we observed with Mike Lowenstein. But, and we're observing the object, which nobody else has observed, because there's nothing to see there. Right? So we come to the astronomers and we say, we want your favorite toy to look in the darkest corner of the universe where you are not going to see anything. Right? And remarkably, they let us do that. But with the cluster data, other people have actually work to do on clusters. And there's a lot more data. And so you get all these backgrounds, but you have a lot more data. And so the game is completely different, and you need to understand those backgrounds. You need to model them correctly. But if you do, then you get a lot of data. So that's the difference.
As you figure out that actually you have a lot of lines, too.
Right.
No, that's sure.
But before we finish, let me mention one more thing, right? So if these particles exist, right? Then, in addition to being produced in the early universe, they can also be produced in a supernova explosion. Right? And supernovae are a good place to look for exclusion or discovery of light particles with masses below the temperature of the supernova, which is in tens of MeV. Okay? So it turns out that the supernova does not constrain this any further, but there is a patch of so this is okay. There's a patch of parameter space here that actually explains something that you want to explain. And that is the velocities of pulsars. And that's an interesting additional piece. So basically, if a particle like this exists, you would see two manifestations. You would see dark matter in the universe, and you would see that pulsars have very large velocities. And both of those check out. So what happens in a supernova? And I want to mention this because Chris Fryer is here, and he actually calculated some of this. And this is an interesting possibility. Okay. So in a supernova, you make a neutron star by compressing the core of a big star with gravity. And then it emits neutrinos, cools down, and becomes a cold magnetized neutron star, which we observe as a pulsar. These pulsars have velocities of 100 kilometers per second. Okay. And about 15% of them have velocities greater than 1,000 kilometers per second. And at least for this population, I don't know of any explanation from asymmetries in the supernova. Okay. And people have claimed that there is a two-component distribution there. Okay, so why would these explain it? Turns out that sterile neutrinos are emitted asymmetrically with the preferential direction set by the magnetic field. Now, neutrinos don't know about the magnetic field, but the electrons do. Okay, and so the rate at which you would produce a neutrino with a spin pointing in the same direction as electron is not the same as the rate that you would produce a neutrino pointing in the opposite direction. And that is true just for ordinary neutrinos.
These are the standard neutrinos.
These are the standard neutrinos, okay, produced in Orca processes. So for standard neutrinos, if you just calculate the asymmetry, you get 10% asymmetry. Turns out that 1% asymmetry can explain these velocities. But for standard neutrinos, that asymmetry is washed out because the neutrinos don't escape from the neutron star with the asymmetry with which they produced. They have to diffuse slowly, and that asymmetry is washed out. For this crowd, it's like baryogenesis. If you have approximate equilibrium, then baryon asymmetry is washed out, even if you have amplitudes that are not symmetric. Okay? But if you have the sterile neutrinos, exactly, they are produced in the same reactions with the suppression of sin squared theta, but they don't have to interact. They just escape with the same asymmetry. And then you explain these very large velocities.
They're produced by mixing.
Yes.
And 10 to the minus 9 is not too small to...
That's right. That's right. So that's what determines this parameter space, where it's not too small. Because if you go to the left of that, it's too small. Okay. Another interesting observation I'd like to share. Suppose you have more rate-tended neutrinos, okay? And some of them are heavier. In a supernova, there's a range of parameters where right-handed neutrinos with a mass about 200 MeV and a small mixing, not very small, 10 to minus 2, they're not ruled out by nuclear synthesis or anything else. That's in the window where nuclear synthesis is still allowed. But they would be produced in the core of a supernova. With some suppression, they are 200 MeV there, you know, temperature is 70 MeV, so there's some suppression. They're produced with some suppression in the core of the supernova, and then they would decay right outside, and they would put energy behind the shock wave helping the supernova explode. So that is another interesting possibility. Finally, there's one issue that sometimes I get questions about, and that's the N effective. Okay? The effective number of degrees of freedom measured in CMB. Okay? So people often say that, okay, N effective is 3 or 4, so we know that there is 0 or 1 sterile neutrinos. Right? And just as a counterexample, George Fuller, Chad Kishimoto, and I calculated what can happen if you introduce one sterile neutrino into the mix. Okay, and what an effect if you can get. So if I take the standard model and add one sterile neutrino, but I'm allowed to take any mass or mixing, what do you think an effective is going to be?
If you mean by a sterile neutrino, a thermally populated neutrino-like particle, I'll tell you the answer.
Well, no. Okay, it's thermally populated, but it could be heavy. I can take it.
Sure.
I can take it to be with a mass larger than the mass for which you would tell me the answer. Okay? So I can actually make this go up or go down.
Yeah.
Okay, I can make this go to 2.
That's true.
Okay? Because if I dial the mass to be above the pion mass, then I have decay that produces more photons than neutrinos, and then I end up with diluting plasma. And if I dial it a little bit lower, I'll produce more neutrinos than photons, and then I add neutrinos, right? So I can actually make that an effective go up or go down. Right? Just
is there any paper which is like computing this as a function of the neutrino?
Yeah, it's Kishimoto, Fuller, Kishimoto, and I. Yeah.
So has anyone ever actually done a modeling of this the pulsar kick with realistic conditions, or is it still at the level of estimates?
Well, Chris calculated this. Essentially, what happens in a supernova if you give a pull to or a push to the neutron star. And he found some very interesting things. First of all, the breaking of spherical symmetry in the whole explosion puts more energy behind the shock, which is interesting by itself. Second, there is a correlation between the direction of motion and the symmetry in the supernova. And there are other interesting correlations. For example, here, so a neutron star has an axis of rotation. And then the magnetic field develops in a convective dynamo in this convective layer about a kilometer or two below the surface. And so the eddy currents here don't know about the eddy currents here, so there's just some random magnetic field which is inclined and off-centered. So now this thing spins, and so x and y components are washed out, and only z component survives. So what you expect is the correlation between the axis of rotation and the direction of motion. And for all the pulses for which it was measured, there is this correlation.
Yeah, but this was not a simulation of magnetic fields.
No. No, this is just the obvious argument. Based on observation that, And then there's another interesting thing that not only the velocities, but also the spins of pulsars are somewhat mysterious, because if you take the core of a big star is pinned by a magnetic field to the rest of the star up until about 1,000 years before the collapse. And if you take the angular momentum of that thing, it doesn't add up to what you need at the end in the pulsar. So if the force is off-centered and responsible for the velocities, then its spin-up can also explain the missing angular momentum. And there was a paper by Strelfini and his student explaining this. And here, this would work, because you actually have an off-centered magnetic field.
Well, I would think,
what's it?
It's a super hard problem, I understand. To do
it is. It is a super,
right?
Yes.
So
yes.
Right. They don't know how to do the Earth dynamo, so
right.
They certainly can.
But we know that in the Earth the magnetic field is well-centered dipole, because there is convection in the center. And in Uranus, and Neptune, there was never convection in the center, and the convection took place in the thin spherical shell below the surface. And so the prediction was that Uranus and Neptune would have off-centered magnetic fields, and the Pioneer craft, when measured that and confirmed it, that was a great triumph of science. So at least we know that off-centered magnetic fields do result from thin spherical shell dynamos. Okay, so that's, but again, so all of these are kind of pieces in the puzzle which paint a consistent picture. Right? Consistency is not a proof of existence, but at least we have not encountered any inconsistency.
I have a question for
yes.
both, actually. One of the reasons to consider this thing weird contributions of neutrinos decaying, this, that, the other, depositing extra energy, is that in one-dimensional, two-dimensional simulations of supernova explosion without any of this extra neutrino properties, the supernovas don't explode. Seems to be now that in three-dimensional they do explode. Is that correct?
It's true that in even two-dimension they can get them to explode depending on who's running the model. It's at the detail level of the how you're modeling the convection and this kind of thing that determines whether you're exploding.
Convection, you said?
Yeah, so this is not the convection Alex is talking about. It's convection above the photoneutron star.
Okay.
And in that case, depending on how well you started the convection, so a lot of the models that are getting explosions right now, they're getting two weak explosions too late in time. So they're taking 500 milliseconds to explode, and they're exploding.
Is it two-dimensional or three-dimensional?
Both two and three, depending on who you are. Three makes it easier to explode or makes it harder to explode. what that's really saying is we're not even, so Alex was saying we can't model MHC. We're not actually even modeling the hydrodynamics perfectly yet, even if you didn't have magnetic fields. So depending on what algorithm you're using to model the hydrodynamics, you're getting different results. But it's at the level that several groups are getting explosions. They look like they're too weak, even in 3D. you have to, most of the mechanisms used right now, the codes used right now, are damping out some of the instabilities, and so they're taking them longer to explode than they should. I think if once they start resolving on that, they will find that they can get explosions that are roughly the same energy. Although I'm not sure that's why, I mean, that wouldn't be why I was interested in this. You know, this was more to explain the kicks.
Right.
Which I think none of the mechanisms will explain, at least these large kicks. We're getting asymmetries, but not at the level that you would explain a large kick to the full source.
Can we go back to an effective, in your model now, with your sterile neutrino dark matter candidate, itself will make no contribution
right.
to an effect.
That's right.
So say again, or maybe I didn't fully understand, you predict an effective should be 3.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, because that right-handed neutrino is just dark matter.
Right. That's okay.
I said that, if in addition to this right-handed
sure.
neutrino,
you put more part.
Right. There's something else stuck on this brain, okay? And gives different mass scale.
And depending upon whether that has electromagnetic couplings or not, you get an effect of less than 3.
Oh, no. It's just depending on the mass and mixing. Because once you make the mass greater than the pion mass, there is a new channel of decay that opens
yeah.
up.
But 3 corresponds to just number of generation, right?
Yes, that's right.
So maybe you said this, but so you get 2 to 4. If you get 2 to 4, it would be just a surprise if it turns out to be 3.
Right. No. I mean, I was making just the following statement that oftentimes people think that
yeah.
sterile neutrinos are measured directly in this way. But what is measured is a coefficient between the expansion rate and the density of light particles. And that coefficient can be affected by decays of new particles. So if you just take the standard model and throw in some right-handed neutrino with some mass and some mixing, an effective can go up or can go down.
I don't understand that. I mean, in your specific model.
Oh, in my specific model, that's not an issue. Because this is just dark matter,
yeah.
and it acts like dark matter and does nothing else.
Okay.
Right.
So you predict n equals 3.
Right.
This model.
That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right.
So this sterile neutrino doesn't do anything for neutrino anomalies. Right?
This one doesn't.
When you bring in some sterile neutrino, which might have some relevance to neutrino anomalies,
right.
would the cosmology be completely upset?
Well, it depends on the mass and the mixing of this new neutrino.
Okay. Diabe, the results from Diabe got published today.
Oh.
And they see no evidence of EV sterile neutrinos.
In some range of masses and mixing.
Not up to the -9.
Right, exactly.
EV.
Right, exactly.
So they assume the new reactor rate too?
Mm-hmm.
Was it an arc?
No, they don't need to use the reactor rate.
Near and far? Or
yeah, they can look at the difference.
So it's a predictive range.
If an oscillation has occurred before the neutrinos reach even the near detectors there, I don't think they're sensitive to it at all.
Well, but you can't oscillate back.
No. If the oscillation is fast, then you see
non-labeling. Of course, there is a certain range that they are only. There's a range that they are sensitive.
Far be it from me to criticize that.
I think it's almost 12 noon, so and this is another discussion actually. So maybe we should either ask something else.
So the program is there's a
we should think
talks tomorrow. Yeah, that was all very nice.
Thank you.